Committee on Environment and Natural Resources will come to order. I just wanted to make a brief comment. I don't know how many of you had a chance to see the presentation by the fifth graders in the rotunda about an hour ago. They were students from my district, but they put on a patriotic choir concert that was really something to see. And I mean, this has nothing to do with any particular bill that we're hearing today. But when they were, what's struck me was when they were talking about the preamble of our Constitution, talking about making a more perfect union and to ensure domestic tranquility, it just reminded me that no matter how much we debate and argue and bicker and get mad at each other, that's what we're all trying to do here, is to create a more perfect union, no matter how big or small the bill is. Just an editorial remark. Senate File 2329, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this on?
It is.
All right, thank you. Mr. Chair, Senate File 2329, it says Pappas on the top. This is a bill Senator Pappas asked me to carry in her stead. And simply put, Mr. Chair and members, mourning doves were listed as a species that we can hunt about 4 years ago after about 40 years of attempts to bring about a mourning dove season. And as you recall, that happened through a kind of a quirky floor process, and I'm not sure exactly what happened. I was there, and I still am scratching my head how exactly it happened after all these years. And as you probably also know, Mr. Chair, my predecessor, Senator Speer, was somewhat instrumental in the debates that we had through the years, with a fairly humorous presentation that he made, pointing out the fact that mourning doves, as a game bird per se, if we're talking about making a meal out of them, kind of a stretch of the imagination. Very quickly, Mr. Chair, since that was passed, I've heard from people nonstop who really question the appropriateness of hunting these birds. There are different views and different classifications, but a lot of folks feel like mourning doves are small songbirds, are often not really hunted for the traditional purposes that other types of game birds are hunted. There's no strong wildlife management rationale to hunt them. There's certainly no problems with the population, other than a few years ago we did see a precipitous decline, not from hunting, from reasons that we don't fully understand, but in terms of wildlife management practices and the like. They're easily mistaken for kestrels, you know, the smaller hawks, the merlins. When one mourning dove is killed out of a mating pair, then that pair is destroyed forever. There are concerns about the fact that many of them aren't retrieved. Because they're not waterfowl, they can be shot with lead shot. Those that eat carrion, those who come in and eat them, the other wildlife then are exposed to that lead, which is harmful. And for those reasons and others that my witnesses will articulate, it's time to have another discussion and debate about whether or not it's appropriate to hunt mourning doves in Minnesota.
Thank you. I'll proceed with your witnesses.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to start with lost my list here.
Susan Brunell.
Would you like to start?
Oh, yes. Hi, my name is Susan Brunell. I have a background as a veterinary technician. I'm also a volunteer for MARS, the Midwest Avian Adoption and Rescue Services, and for the Raptor Center, and I've also done transport for the Wildlife Rehab Center. I am a former hunter. I do not hunt at the moment. I have focused my attention more on rescue and rehabilitation. I would say that 99% of the animals that I do rescue are birds. I've become more involved with birds because, unfortunately, they have been put in a separate category from most other animals, and I think they deserve more attention than that they're getting. I do know something about doves, and that was pointed out. Their size, they're about 4 to 6 ounces. Only about 2 ounces of that is of the bird is edible, which is the breast meat. They are very fast flyers. They fly between 30 and 50 miles an hour. And they are also a very skittish bird. I have talked with the Wildlife Rehab Center about this, and their experience also has been that compared to even pigeons, they are very erratic flyers, and which does make them very difficult to hit and actually kill. They do not, at the rehab center, get a lot of doves in just because they're not in a hunting area. They have had some pellet-wounded pigeons in, which they said most have had to been euthanized. Because they're so small, they're not as easily to treat if they're rehabilitated as a larger bird. The other thing that was mentioned is that they do blend into the vegetation which when they are wounded, which makes them very difficult to retrieve. And because they fly in flocks, more than one may be wounded at a time, and it is harder for them to be retrieved. The other thing is that's about 50 to 70%, depending on the source, say that most of the fledglings, which are the birds that have just learned to fly, die within the first year due to different, like, predation or habitat changes, environment, weather, things like that. I've talked with several hunters. My brothers are hunters. My whole family basically hunts. And I have nothing against hunting. I just, a responsible hunting, I should say, where the birds are actually retrieved when they are downed. You have a letter, I believe, from my brother who has a story about how he witnessed a dove hunt, and he was appalled that the hunters did not pick up the dead birds and the wounded ones, and he did go pick them up and did eat them. He said it took about a little over four birds to make one meal for one adult. His opinion is that he does not believe that they should be hunted because of their smallness of size, and there are many other birds that are larger that could be hunted instead. And he also, the first thing he said to me was that I asked him about dove hunting. He says, "Oh, you mean the target birds?" And I thought he was joking, but he said, "Well, that's kind of what most of my friends think of them as." You also have a letter from a veterinarian and a physician as far as what happens to these birds if they are wounded and not retrieved. So I won't go into that because you have the letter there. And I believe you also have a letter from MARS, the avian group, with a lot of statistics that I don't think I need to go over because I don't know all the statistics. Some of my concerns are that these birds, besides being maimed and not being retrieved, they will suffer a prolonged death if they're not retrieved. They can survive because they hide in the vegetation, and they can survive for a while. They will feed off their own body fat and to survive. The youth hunts are another one of my concerns. I actually read an article written by a DNR officer who said that these are great birds for adults to teach their youth on how to hunt. And to me, that basically meant target practice. And I think that the smaller the bird, the harder they are to hit and kill. The other thing I want to bring up, and my last point, is that I know that people think that there's an abundance of these birds, but there's the Carolina parakeet also at one time was very abundant. In fact, I've heard of stories being said that they had actually black in the sky. There were so many of them. They are now extinct. The last one died in a zoo in Ohio in 1918. And I think that this very well could happen to the mourning doves also. And it's just from the people I've talked to, not one of them that I have has said that they agree that these birds should be on the hunted list, that they are our backyard songbirds. Thank you.
Thank you. Question for the witness, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you clarify that last bird you talked about? That was a hunted bird, was it?
Yes, it was hunted for feathers down south.
Do you think that would happen with the mourning dove? Should that continue?
Senator, would you mind putting your microphone a little closer to you?
Is it your opinion that hunting doves would actually drive them towards extinction?
I think it possibly could. I'm not an expert on it, but I think that it could.
Thank you.
Your next witness?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to call John Arthur of the Audubon Society to the table.
Hello there. I'm John Arthur, president of the Audubon chapter of Minneapolis. Thank you for asking me to come here today. At one time, our chapter, we the board of directors did support the original bill that allowed mourning dove hunting. We got a lot of feedback from our membership that was not a good idea, and why did we do that? We'd like to admit we were wrong, and we'd now like to go on record as opposing the dove hunting. Most of the members that have talked to me about it have said that there's not enough meat on these things. We have members of our board of directors who are duck hunters. We have a turkey hunter, avid turkey hunter. I have no problem with it. That's a good thing. I buy duck stamps. In our family, we bought 4 duck stamps this year. Again, we don't see the reason for hunting these birds. They seem to be, as a previous witness stated, are for the purpose of target practice. I find clay pigeons a much better thing in the dove family than a pigeon or than a mourning dove. Sorry, there's a lot of things to shoot at other than that. There are other game birds. There are ducks. There are turkeys. If you want to shoot a bird, some of them are a lot better eating. I don't care if the mourning dove tastes like chicken. I still don't believe it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for the witness? Your next witness?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to call Bill Oldfather from the Minnesota Green Party.
Honored senators, audience, and citizens of Minnesota, my name is Bill Oldfather. I live in May Township, north of Stillwater, and I've been volunteering for the Green Party for 6 years. I'm truly honored to be representing the Green Party of Minnesota. This prepared statement, which I am about to read, was a collaboration of 3 leaders of the Minnesota Green Party and is thought to represent the views of the Minnesota State Green Party and its platform, the National Green Party and its platform, and the Green Parties of various nations of the world. Please feel invited to explore and join the Green Party, the Party of Peace, the Party of Reform, the Party of Ecological Wisdom, and the Party of the Future. I commence with our prepared statement. Representing the views of at least 75,000 voters throughout the state, the Green Party of Minnesota heartily endorses this proposed mourning dove hunting prohibition legislation. In 2006, we passed a resolution demanding that the statute allowing the hunting of mourning doves be immediately repealed. This prohibition is in keeping with our holistic philosophy of living in harmony with nature and in adherence with our roots as an environmental party. 2 of the Green Party's 10 key values are nonviolence and ecological wisdom. Regarding nonviolence, the hunting of mourning doves has arguably been for the sole purpose of target practice. The taking of life demands a complete evaluation of motives and needs and should commence only with great respect and dignity. Target practice falls far short of such considerations. Doves are also a symbol of peace. Regarding ecological wisdom, numerous studies have found it takes as many as 8 rounds before a hunter hits a mourning dove. Further, studies of mourning dove hunting patterns have demonstrated that an unusually high number of mourning doves are not recovered after being shot. These studies suggest that in comparison to other forms of hunting, the shooting of mourning doves has introduced higher amounts of lead and other substances and material into the environment. The hunting of mourning doves has also reduced numbers of a songbird enjoyed for many by many for its song. It should also be noted that unlike some species, which are considered by some to be pests because they eat farmers' crops, mourning doves actually benefit farmers by eating the seeds of weeds. That's the end of my statement. Thank you very much for considering the views and philosophies of the Green Party.
Thank you. Questions for the witness? Mr. Oldfather, you were talking about some studies. Would you be able to cite those studies at all?
Those words came from a fellow Green who collaborated on this project, and I would be checking with him, but I would think he could.
Mr. Chair, we can provide those studies if the committee would be interested in seeing them. Yes.
So, okay. Next witness.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll conclude our testimony with Howard Goldman of the Humane Society.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's a great opportunity for me to share with you our views. I appreciate this opportunity. I'm the...
If you wouldn't mind introducing yourself as
sure,
well for our
which I was
record.
Just going to do.
Thank you.
My name is Howard Goldman, and I'm the regional director for the Central States for the Humane Society of the United States, which is the largest animal protectionist organization in the country. We have over 10 million members and supporters. In Minnesota, we have over 159,000 members and supporters in every single legislative district in the state. And I'm submitting testimony today to support the passage of Senate File 2329, a bill that would prohibit the taking of mourning doves. I think you all have copies of my testimony in your material. I'll try to make my comments brief, but I do want to address several different areas this morning. Senate File 2329 would restore protection to Minnesota's mourning doves. Over the past 58 years, during the time when the mourning dove was protected, many efforts were undertaken to remove that protection. I was present during at least 15 of those efforts. And in each instance, they were defeated. And they were defeated for one very good reason, because Minnesotans care deeply about this particular bird, and they want it protected again. As has been stated earlier, shooting doves serve no wildlife management purpose. They don't pose a threat to agricultural crops, homes, or anything else of value to people. They are the farmer's friend because they consume weed seeds. They're not overpopulated in Minnesota. During the hearings back in 2004, we were told during the debate in the Senate that the number of hunters taking mourning doves would increase very quickly to 50,000 statewide. Well, that hasn't happened. Over the past 3 years, during which time the season has been open, the number of hunters has varied between 11 and 15,000. And in 06, the latest period during which we have harvest numbers, 86,000 mourning doves were taken. This is an experiment that has failed. There is no widespread support, even within the hunting community, for a season on mourning dove. There's almost 600,000 deer hunters in the state. Of course, we compare that to the mourning dove numbers, they pale by comparison. As was mentioned earlier, doves are not a viable human food source. They're 4 ounces, and when they're fully dressed, they're little more than 2 ounces. It takes 4 to 8 to make a meal. Dove shooting contributes to the discharge of toxic lead. That's also been mentioned. Let me just add a few comments to that. There's a long-term study that was conducted by the U.S. Geological Survey and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Densities of greater than 860,000 pellets per hectare were reported in dove fields. Cumulative lead deposits pose a significant risk to ground feeding mourning doves, other birds of prey, and other animals that scavenge on down birds. The shooting of doves raises many ethical concerns, some of which we've already talked about. Hunters have told me that doves are fun to shoot because they fly erratically. They've been called jokingly cheap skeet Shooting doves, moreover, is known to produce orphaned young. Doves have the longest nesting season of all North American birds and are known to still be nesting during the 60-day hunting season. Doves mate for life. And because both parents are usually required to successfully fledge their young, killing one parent is known to cause unnecessary suffering and starvation. Moreover, as has been already mentioned, there's unacceptably high wounding rate, and we will produce that information, Mr. Chair, for you to review. Moreover, shooting doves is also known to produce mistaken identity kills, including American kestrels, sharp-shinned hawks, killdeer, and several other federally protected species. In 2003 at the State Fair, the Minnesota House of Representatives conducted a straw poll on this very issue, and voters overwhelmingly opposed the establishment of a mourning dove season by over a 3-to-1 margin. The survey, sampling a total of 7,400 Minnesotans, revealed that only 18% favored dove hunting, while 56% opposed it, and 23% were undecided. There's also the economic impact we have to talk about. Mourning doves are beloved backyard birds and are an important part of the multi-million dollar bird watching and feeding industry in Minnesota. More Minnesota residents participate in wildlife watching, spend more money doing it than any other outdoor activity, including all forms of hunting. While there are over 550,000 hunters in the state of Minnesota, there are over 1,900,000 wildlife watchers in the state who contribute in excess of $650,000 to the state economy. Now, in your packet, there's a statement from the Archbishop, which I'd like to refer you to. Well, I'm happy to say supports our efforts in this regard, and I just want to read the last few lines. The Archbishop states, "Mourning doves are gentle, friendly birds that are considered the emblem of peace and the harbinger of spring in the Bible. With this in mind, we support legislation, Senate File 2329, that will once again protect Minnesota mourning doves from hunting." The issue of numbers of doves surfaced a little bit earlier. The Fish and Wildlife Service conducted, as they do every 10 years, an analysis of the mourning dove population. And I would just like to read a few statistics from that. They looked at this from several different vantage points. They conducted a survey on the number of mourning doves heard along call counts, and they've compared it over the past 10 years, 1996 to the year 2000. They've seen a decline of over 5% in the state of Minnesota. They conducted a second survey. The number of mourning doves seen along the same call count survey routes, same 10-year period. They concluded the population had declined by over 7%. Finally, they looked at the breeding population indices, which is perhaps the most critical figure. They started out with a factor of 32. That was in 1966. In the year 2006, that had declined to 11.4. Now, we're not saying that the population is threatened or endangered at this point. We're simply saying that it's pretty clear that the population is declining. In fact, in the conclusion, the Fish and Wildlife Survey, they said that the central unit, of which Minnesota is a part, clearly has a declining trend in the number of doves. And our point is briefly this, that why, knowing that the population is declining, why take additional 100,000 mourning doves, along with all the other reasons I've mentioned, when we know it's simply going to add to the loss of mourning doves in the state? Finally, I want to say that the Minnesota Humane Society and several other Minnesota-based wildlife and animal welfare groups support this effort. In conclusion, we want to urge you to pass this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for the witness, Senator Saxog.
Just a statement, Mr. Golden. I hate to correct the Archbishop, but everything I've ever read said the turtle dove, not the mourning dove, is a symbol of peace.
Well, this was the Archbishop's
Mr.
words.
Golden.
And frankly, I'd rather have the Archbishop address that. But I do understand your point, Senator.
The last point you made, Mr. Goldman, on why create a hunting season
if there's an indication that populations are declining. That was probably the reason why I did not support legalizing the dove season in the first place 4 years ago. But as you testified now, so few hunters, as you had testified, have gotten into dove hunting. How could we then argue that there's any impact from the hunting of doves on the population if so few have impacted it?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would take a broader view of that question. Of course, it is a very legitimate question. We're asking that the committee protect mourning doves not only because of the declining population trend, but we think that's a critical issue, but for all the other reasons we cited. There's no trophy value, no meat value. They're used for target practice. And in addition, the population is declining. And knowing that, we would urge the committee to provide protection for the mourning doves once again.
On the target practice issue, do you have information on who stated that doves were cheap skeet? You said that they've been called.
I did, and skeet. I don't have that with me, and I can certainly pull that reference together.
I think that would be important. I've never heard that, and so I'd be curious as to who said that. Let me ask you this. Can pheasant be hunted with lead shot?
I can't answer that. I presume so. I know there's representatives from the Department of Natural Resources here.
Senator Dibble?
As I understand, Mr. Chair, the prohibition is of using lead shot is for waterfowl.
Okay. So you can hunt pheasant with lead shot at the moment.
Mr. Chairman?
Can you hunt rough grouse, sharp-tailed grouse with lead?
Well, I don't want to be the definitive. The DNR can, Mr. Chair, can probably answer that question.
It should be a simple nod. Is someone from the DNR over there? Just nod or shake your head if
you can.
DNR said yes. So.
Can you hunt the gray partridge and bobwhite quail with lead?
Vargas?
Partridge. Quail.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I didn't hear the question.
Can you hunt the gray partridge, bobwhite, quail with lead?
Mr. Chair, yes.
That was Ed Vargas in the DNR. Can you hunt the American woodcock with lead?
Yes.
Does the Humane Society support banning the hunting of those birds, since you can hunt them with lead?
We support the use of steel shot because of the environmental consequences to the use of lead shot. That's been our frame for this discussion. But we distinguish the mourning dove, frankly, from – this is not an anti-hunting initiative, as you know. We think that the mourning dove really is a bird of special concern for the state of Minnesota.
Well, it was stated that one of the problems is that you use toxic shot, and so I was just curious if that's the only one that we can use. Senator Dibble?
The point about the lead shot, Mr. Chair, 2 points. One is I think the argument goes that tend to fire a lot more shots that miss at a bird that flies so erratically. So you get a lot more shot just kind of laying around on the ground, and also that a lot of these birds aren't retrieved, and so other animals come and eat those birds, and they ingest the lead shot.
Okay. Then the other question I had was, how many ounces of meat come from a woodcock?
No idea.
I don't know.
They're pretty small, too. And then I guess the final question is, does the Humane Society of the United States support the ban of all hunting?
No, it does not. I mean, we look at each individual species and the circumstances surrounding that particular species. So we're not opposed to recreational hunting.
Could that be contrary to what I've read on the information on the website for the Humane Society?
Senator, our position, members of the committee, our position has evolved. There was a point at which that was being considered as the position for the Humane Society of the United States. It no longer is. That's many years ago.
That's changed in the last month?
No. That's changed many years ago. You may have read a quote, perhaps, from someone who works for the Humane Society, and I don't know the context, of course, or the circumstances.
That was a policy position. I guess someone can go and look it up. Senator Dibble, did you have a comment?
Oh, I just wanted to say, for the record, I don't oppose hunting, and in fact, have hunted, and if you invite me on one of your expeditions, I'll go hunting with you sometime, okay. Mr. Chair.
Senator Saxog, did you have your hand up?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to make one other comment, because this has come up many times, and that's the food value of such a small bird. And the analogy that I've always used is the sunfish, which is about 4 ounces, and if you clean it, or if you can get, when I was a kid, if I get my dad to clean all the sunfish, we end up with about a 2 ounce fillet. And so that's about as close as I can get to an analogy, and I think it holds true. Small fish that the kids pick.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I too would like to know, or who may have stated that a sportsman has considered this a cheap skeet. And couple other comments, if I could, with regards to the DNR is here. We're checking on what's legal and what isn't legal, but I think it is illegal to not retrieve fowl in the state of Minnesota. And I have to personally say that I'm a avid hunter, upland game hunter myself, and hunted for many years, and hunted with an awful lot of people, and I've never once hunted with anybody or even heard anybody talk about not retrieving birds. I think it actually goes against the ethics of the Minnesota sportsman, and I think by just throwing those kinds of terms out without having any kind of proof, I think is a little premature and bothersome to me. So just a comment. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, Senator,
Mr. Goldman. Go ahead.
We do have studies. I believe they were conducted by the University of Illinois. And in that instance, when they did their analysis, they concluded that the wounding rate was close to 30%. And I'll be happy to pull that together. I believe it was the University of Illinois for your review.
Thank you.
I mean, this is not anecdotal.
Senator Parasol.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have to just state, after hearing the last few things, that I'm sorry that I was late for the beginning of this meeting. But when we put this bill together years ago to bring it to the season that we enjoy today, we were absolutely certain, between the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the national groups that do good bird counts, and the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, that we have a very sustainable population here in the state of Minnesota, because doves have a high reproduction rate. And so we didn't put this in place without a lot of input from high sources.
Is that a response? Okay. Thank you for your testimony. We'll take next on the witness list is John Schroers. And if Mr. Schroers, Mr. Leaf, and Mr. McMillan would all like to come up at the same time, we can facilitate that more efficiently. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is John Schroers, and I'm the past president of the Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance. I'm their current legislative coordinator.
I'm Gary Leaf with Sportsman for Change.
Mr. Chair, I do have some handouts.
We'll pass those out.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's a great pleasure that we have the opportunity to speak to you in regards to this particular issue. We have other folks in the room that will be who are expert on this issue, and if need be, we'd be, with your permission, willing to call them forward. I'd like to give you a little background in regards to organizations that are opposed to Minnesota's hunting and fishing tradition. And I refer to the time frame of the early 1990s. Organizations like the Humane Society of the United States, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, were extremely active in Minnesota and were targeting organizations and hunting traditions in specific pertaining to archery deer, our trappers, and some types of fishing endeavors, which caused great alarm in the outdoor community. They were very active. The then, and I assume still, Chief Executive Officer of the Humane Society of the United States, Mr. Wayne Pacell, was very active in that time frame debating archery deer with our DNR experts. This led to representatives of said organization actually going to the field and interfering with legal hunts, specifically archery deer hunts in the Murphy-Hanrahan Park Reserve in Scott County. This led to a couple of legislative solutions. Number one would have been, is, the enactment by this legislature of a hunter harassment law. Since its enactment, it is no longer legal to engage in harassing a legal hunt by anyone for any particular reason. The Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance was formed in the early 1990s to address the continued attacks on our outdoor heritage by organizations like the Humane Society of the United States. MOHA is an umbrella group of all the hunting, fishing concerns, conservation concerns in the state. We came together and we pushed for and passed by 78% of the folks voting in 1998 constitutional protections protecting our hunting, fishing, and trapping heritage. We are a right-to-hunt state, the second one in the nation. Our model has been copied by other states since that time. I'd like to address a few of the arguments brought forward today. In particular, the wanton waste issue, or the non-retrieve issue. Mourning doves are a challenging species to hunt. Absolutely challenging. Much like shooting teal, early season teal hunts. They're a flighty bird that challenge an experienced wing shooter. When we do actually have the opportunity to score a hit, 99% of the hunters I know retrieve their game. They do not allow any critter in the field to be wanton waste, to be allowed to remain. We are required by law to make an honest effort to retrieve all game that we hunt. It's unethical and it's against the law to do otherwise. Let's give some significant some historic significance now to the argument that we are shooting the bird of peace. The Bishop's position notwithstanding. When I testified 4 years ago, I quoted my parish priest, the Reverend Joe Fink, a South Dakotan and an avid upland bird hunter. I had asked Father Joe, give me some guidance. What does the church consider the bird of peace? And he told me it goes back to the days of Noah, the Old Testament, when the ark landed on the mountain. They sent out a crow, thinking that crow was going to find dry land. Well, the crow never came back. The next bird they sent was a pure white turtle dove. He came back with a sprig of vegetation in his mouth. Okay? That historic significance started 3,000 years ago, maybe. Old Testament faithful would go to temple. They could purchase snow-white turtle doves for their offerings in temple, further cementing the historical significance of the bird of peace. And New Testament doctrine attributes the Holy Spirit, part of the Trinity, to the bird of peace. So that definition has that long historical significance. Now, sportsmen have a habit of calling their quarry many things. We give a lot of our birds and other critters nicknames, and that's true in Minnesota, and it's true nationwide. For example, the mallard duck is referred to by Minnesota waterfowlers as a green head or a curly tail, a gray back, that's a canvas back. Chinese ringneck pheasant, sometimes referred to as a ditch parrot or a thunder chicken. Okay? Mourning dove, sometimes referred to in Minnesota and across the nation as a sharp-tailed dove, rock pigeon. That's derived from the gravelly areas that they get their grit, rock pigeon. So we identify our prey by many names, not necessarily the bird of peace. Hunting doves, some more refuting. And enlightenment. Hunting doves has been a great recruitment tool for getting the young folks involved in the outdoors. I have Dan Richmond here, and he could give us, well, probably 120 reasons why it's a good thing. He's mentored 120 kids over in the Hastings area. I hunt doves in the south of Shakopee and Scott County. I, too, have introduced many young kids. Our handouts show youth involvement. On the lands that I lease for goose hunting is where we shoot most of our doves. We use non-toxic exclusively. We do not use lead shot. This reestablished dove season is reconnected as a reconnected part of our heritage, that we are certain will continue to grow. We've only been at it 4 years, and the participation levels have gone up, have gone down, but with further recruitment efforts, we're very confident that the folks that would use the opportunity to continue to grow the opportunity. I'm going to wrap up my comments reminding you folks that this is a right to hunt state, and on behalf of the Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance, we would urge a no vote on Senate File 2329. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Questions for the witness. Does the Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance support legalizing the hunting of turtle doves?
No, sir. No, Mr. Chair. We shouldn't be shooting snow white turtle doves. That's never been a game species. The mourning dove, for almost 100 years, to my knowledge, has been.
Okay. Further questions? All right. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair,
introducing yourself again.
Yep. Mr. Chair, members, I'm Gary Leaf. I'm the executive director of Sportsman for Change. And number of the comments that John made, I'll try to make some different points on this. I think that the main point with regard to this, if you take a look at hunting and angling over the last 100 years, we are pretty much self-regulated. There's a number of different tiers to this. There's the federal level, the state level, and then, of course, we have a whole array of private sector conservation groups. They're very in tune with the varying species. We can see certain species that were revived in Minnesota or didn't even exist in Minnesota because of hunters. Certainly the ringneck pheasant was non-indigenous to the United States. The whole population of pheasants was built starting in the early 1900s, went through some difficulties, and then expanded. The turkey that people are may end up being a nuisance bird that are all over the state of Minnesota now, that was brought in by hunters. The revival of Canadian geese. When I first started duck hunting, Canadian geese were extremely a rare sighting in Minnesota. Those things have all rebounded. Now, in comparison, if you take a look at dove hunting, doves, mourning doves, are the most populous game bird in the United States. But if you compare them to pheasants, they're far and away greater. If you compare them to turkeys, they're far and away greater. Or ducks, they're far and away greater. It's the most populous game bird in the United States. But I really think it comes down to what is the science saying. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is supportive of having a dove hunting season, which is why it's in 40 other states. The DNR is supportive of it. And we have, you know, a lot of activity in that realm. There are, on the whole, I would say, a lot of sportsmen in Minnesota that are aware of this issue, are supportive of dove hunting. They may or may not even be mourning dove hunters. And the main reason is they see it as a part of the whole landscape of outdoor activities. To compare it with target hunting, I think, is insulting to, will be insulting to a lot of sportsmen, because if you're actually a hunter or an angler, I would say that the bulk of time you spend a field, you don't actually even see anything, let alone get anything. And it's not all that easy to go dove hunting. And the idea that, you know, they're firing 3, 4, 5, 10, or 8 shots or something at a bird that fast is almost virtually impossible. So I think that as long as the science continues to support it, the sportsmen would be the first ones to be here to testify that they should remove the season on that. And there's some other information, too, about that. A lot of the birds in areas where they are hunting, I know a number of people that used to go to North Dakota, they enjoyed mourning dove hunting so much. A lot of these birds aren't the birds that are at your bird feeder anyway. I mean, they're going to stay pretty much in the areas that they were raised in and where they're hunted in. So we don't think there's going to be any effects on wildlife watching, if you will. And that pretty much wraps up what my testimony is. I just want to touch on a couple of those points. But.
Questions for the witness? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Member?
Does anyone in the audience wish to testify for or against this bill? Mr. Bass. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Ed Bogus with DNR Division of Fish and Wildlife. I won't repeat a lot of the things that have been said, just to set the record straight on the question you asked earlier from when I was behind the table, that you can't shoot bobwhite quail with lead in Minnesota because we don't have a bobwhite quail season in Minnesota. So just to set the record straight on that, the
it's
DNR...
It's a game bird, but we don't have a bobwhite quail.
It's a game, it is a game bird, Mr. Chairman, okay. But we don't have an open season. So.
Okay.
The DNR has been supportive of the dove hunting season, as has already been mentioned by the testifiers. The mourning dove is a migratory game bird under the International Migratory Bird Treaty, as well as by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. It's the most abundant game bird species in the United States. We have to set a season in Minnesota under a framework established by the federal government. The populations are monitored on an annual basis, and we have to set our season length and our limits within the federal framework, just like we do for other migratory birds like waterfowl. I guess with that, the population in Minnesota is healthy. A very small proportion of the population, either in Minnesota or nationally, is taken by hunting. There have been some long-term population declines documented across a large area of North America. Given their gradual long-term nature, it's believed that those are due to habitat factors, and there's certainly no indication that hunting has been a factor that suppresses the population, and the Fish and Wildlife Service does monitor that very carefully. We have seen some interest in dove hunting in Minnesota. It wasn't as much as we had at first guessed, but there has not been the tradition here like there has been in other states, and Minnesota is also blessed with a variety of hunting opportunities. But just to summarize, we are supportive of the current season. We think it's very well regulated scientifically, and urge your support for continuing it. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Parasol.
Mr. Chairman, it just occurred to me when Mr. Boggess was speaking that we had a discussion earlier when we put the season in place that I believe the mourning dove is one of the birds that's regulated, that is actually legitimized through an international treaty. Is that not correct? It's an international treaty.
Mr. Chair and Senator Parasol, it is under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act with Canada, the United States, and Mexico. It's considered a migratory game bird.
Thank you.
How many ounces of meat can you get from a woodcock?
I was afraid you were going to ask me that, Mr. Chair. I'm guessing 3 to 4 ounces.
How about the gray partridge?
Mr. Chair, gray partridge would have substantially more. Snipe, which is another migratory game bird, would be more similar in size to a dove.
Okay. Mr. Schroers passed out some information. I'm reading several pages in, second from the last page of his packet, and I'm just wondering if you can confirm or deny this. 2006 Minnesota August Roadside Survey, Sharon Getz, Farmland Wildlife Populations and Research Group. The number of mourning doves observed in 2006 increased 50% from last year, 37% above the 10-year average, and was similar to the long-term average. Counts increased significantly in 5 of 7 regions. Is that a DNR report?
Mr. Chair, yes, this is a report that's put out by our Farmland Wildlife Populations and Research Unit out of Medelia. They supervise the August roadside count surveys every year for pheasants and other species.
Okay, other questions of the witness or author? Senator Dibble, you have the last word.
Mr. Chair, we're going to call from the audience for anyone else who wanted to testify.
Yeah.
Okay. So.
Yeah. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce
Thank
yourself.
You for this opportunity. My name is Eileen McCarthy, and I am here representing Three Minnesota-based organizations, Midwest Avian Adoption and Rescue Services, the Avian Welfare Coalition, and the Association of Sanctuaries, and you do have a letter from me in your materials there. In just listening to some of the questions and responses from other witnesses, I felt that I'd like to clarify the questions having to do with the pressure on the species. In most cases, there isn't just one factor that leads to a species decline. There are usually multiple factors. And as was mentioned with the Carolina parakeet and the declining numbers of doves, even when there was not a hunting season for doves, there are other factors involved, and that is land development, agricultural development, possibly global climate change. Things like this can also contribute to pressure on the species. Given the ecology of the mourning dove, in which the nesting and fledging period is so long, where the fledglings are dependent on their parents, and the development that is going on in Minnesota and across the country, and climate change, hunting them would just be one added pressure on the species. And therefore, we're not saying that they would be pushed to the brink of extinction. Hopefully, that would not happen. But why would we want to add one more pressure when there already are clearly pressures that exist? Thank you for hearing me out.
Questions for the witness? Did your group take a position on hunting prairie chicken?
No, we did not.
Because that was completely extinct, at least in Minnesota, until just several years ago, where
right.
it was reintroduced, and now we can hunt it.
And Minnesota has been a state that has been able to help species become replenished and rebound, as some of the hunters have testified. Again, we just need to be careful when we're going to say we're going to add another pressure to a species already under pressure for whatever reasons, whether we know what they are or not. And, you know, the decisions to delist some species that were prohibited from hunting has been made based on the science behind it. And it's not clear to anyone whether they are biologists, conservationists, hunters, or animal advocates exactly what pressures might contribute to the depletion of the species. But certainly, if hunting mourning doves were to increase in the way that the opposition to this bill is suggesting, that would be a significant pressure on the species.
Can't you say that for any species?
Absolutely. You could say that for any species, and that's why it needs to be carefully monitored and why we have organizations like the DNR to do that. However, sometimes unforeseen things come along, like global climate change. You know, we don't really know what's happening, but we know things are changing. And we can't predict that or control it. The other thing is, often when humans interfere and try and manage wildlife, unintended consequences occur that were unforeseen at the time.
All right. Further questions for the witness? Thank you.
Thank you very much for hearing me out.
Senator Dibble, you have the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to respond to one thing said earlier. I think it was suggested that either I or a witness suggested that somehow it takes, you know, that people are firing 8 shots at one bird. I don't think that was the claim. I think it was stated that it takes an average of 8 or more shots before a bird, you know, so a lot of birds get missed or aren't completely felled. Other than that, Mr. Chair, no, I think we've had a good, honest debate, clearly a difference of perception and opinion. People have a very, very different view of whether or not a mourning dove is an appropriate species to hunt, and some arguments that some of the unintended consequences that occur from opening up this season are other reasons to think about whether or not we should have a mourning dove season. Other people think mourning dove is a game bird, and there are a lot of good reasons to hunt mourning dove. So with that, Mr. Chair, I guess I'll just make a motion that this bill be recommended pass and referred where?
Senator Dibble, for any bill that does not need to go to another committee, I've laid them all over for possible inclusion in our omnibus policy bill.
Okay.
So if there's no further discussion on Senate File 2329 from the members, it will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus environment policy bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. Okay. The next bill on the agenda. Senate File 2451, Senator Metzen. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Chairman Chaudhry and members of the committee.
And as the audience exits, if we could just remain courteous to the next bill proposals.
So, Chairman, members, I bring before you what we view as an environmental problem out there. The intent of Senate File 2451 is to regulate the use of construction and demolition waste fines as cover materials in landfills. Companies and solid waste industry brought this issue to my attention. Recently, quite frankly, the Pollution Control Agency approved the use of this material, which was a surprise to me after learning more about the product. The materials cause serious environmental and health problems at other landfills in the nation, we are told. The problem is caused by presence of gypsum, sheetrock, wallboard, which can generate hydrogen sulfide gas. And there's been some deaths in Wisconsin, Superior, Wisconsin, and we believe that these probably could have been caused from this hydrogen sulfide gas problem. I don't know if Dakota County is that smart, but I know that they've banned this product to cover landfills for quite a while, and thought I'd bring that to your attention. They figured that this isn't good stuff to put in our landfills in Minnesota. I've got a couple of folks with me today, John Domke, Vice President of SKB, and Bob Brickner, President of JBB, and they'd like to address. I know your time is short, you have a number of bills, but we'll try to be quick. So Mr. Domke can start.
Senator Olson. Nope, we haven't heard this yet. Okay. Senator Metzen, has this bill been heard anywhere else?
No, this is... and it's such an important bill that we would remember if it had been, but we'll have Mr. Domke, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Senator Metzen.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is John Domke. I'm with SKB Environmental, and I'm speaking today for SKB as well as RRT, who is supporting this bill. They own and operate the processing facilities in Washington Ramsey County as well as Elk River, and the Demcon landfill, who was actually given one of the approvals for this. And since learning of the human health risk involved, have actually stopped taking it and actually are now supporting the bill. I want to make sure that we don't see this as a recycling issue, because this is not a recycling issue. Our company recycles. We recycle over 50% of our waste. This is not a money issue. We don't take waste from these companies at large volumes, and ironically, last year we took in twice as much as any previous year, so it's not a money issue. And it's certainly not a C&D landfill issue that some folks would have you believe that if this is cover and it's going into C&D landfill, it's the same thing. That's absolutely not true. We do save fines in our landfill. However, the important part is we put soils down monthly. Those soils help attenuate hydrogen sulfide gas, movement. In addition, when you screen this material, you're actually putting more gypsum material, which causes hydrogen sulfide gases, into the cover, and you're then substituting that as cover material, not soil, so you have nothing to attenuate the hydrogen sulfide gas movement. And so that is what exactly this is about. This is about hydrogen sulfide gases. That's it. Hydrogen sulfide gas is a very toxic gas. Wouldn't take much more than this shot glass to kill everybody in this room. It's a very deadly gas. At the very least, it's got a very obnoxious odor. It smells like rotten eggs. And as Senator Metzen already explained, it has killed four people just on November 1st at a C&D landfill in Wisconsin, and that is hydrogen sulfide gas. Whether how it was in the C&D landfill, it was in a confined space, that's irregardless. It produces the hydrogen sulfide, and that's what this bill is. And even the MPCA thinks it's obviously a very serious topic, because just 2 years ago, the MPCA at their annual conference gave a overview and a presentation of the dangers of hydrogen sulfide gases in C&D landfills. They mentioned how important it was to try and separate out the gypsum and actually to use best management practices, things that they seem to ignore on right now under their present position. They also had a speaker come from Milwaukee, J.W. Spears, who is an expert at this same conference. This expert testified that also on the dangers of hydrogen sulfide in C&D landfills. He also suggests that it doesn't matter if this material, if it goes to and is used as cover in an MSW landfill or a C&D landfill, that's not the issue. The issue is the sulfur that it produces. There's actually, we've included some of that in your booklet from this expert, J.W. Spears. He also suggests that it needs to be mixed 2-to-1 or 3-to-1 with soils, which is all we've asked, is that our state would view this and use best management practices, such as pulling out the gypsum on the front end, mixing it with soil so that it is safe and doesn't have the potential to produce that. The other thing I want to point out is that there seems to be some confusion on what states do and do not do. I know that in the MPCA's finding, they say 20 states do not have bans on this. However, we and some other companies, we contacted all 50 states, asked some very pinpointed questions about gypsum, drywall, and hydrogen sulfide gases. Over half the states don't have bans because nobody's ever approached them to use it, but they all said that if they did, they would have to address hydrogen sulfide gases. So out of the ones that do accept it, all of them have best management practices in place, or all of them have had hydrogen sulfide problems over the last decade. So it seems to us that our state has taken a position by saying that we don't need to do any kind of best management practices. We've become the state with the most least amount of control on this is of any state that does it. And this is troubling to us because it is a health problem. The other thing that I want to bring to your attention on the MPCA's findings on this material, there's absolutely no scientific documentation for them to allow this in a C&D landfill. They cite CMRA, who is a Construction Material Recycling Association. They cite their testing that they've performed, and they did do some excellent testing, mind you. But the most critical part is if you look at the very second to the last paragraph, they did not check for sulfur or measure sulfur concentration because this is a hot issue. Well, that is the issue. So why wouldn't you test for that? So the only piece that they have in their documentation that even tested for this is whether you see it as a philosophical problem or not, but they did announce to one of the facilities that does the processing that they'd be there 10 times at this time of the day and grab these samples. Well, whatever. But the problem is the way they test. We also did very similar tests, and actually we had the same company run our analytical PACE laboratories. And the problem that we found out is we ran a sample, pure gypsum. The pure gypsum came back at the same levels of the concentration that we took from our transfer station. That raised a bunch of flags with us. We then researched it, why it was coming out that way, and we found in 2007, Dr. Townsend, who's renowned in Florida on the subject of C&D waste and testing procedures, that there is a testing procedure for hydrogen sulfide that needs to be performed, because if you just run it like the normal, not what PACE did was wrong, believe me, what they did was right, but what happens if you got to totally dissolve it, and hydrogen sulfur has to be totally dissolved, you have to run it many times. And they even wrote a letter, and we include in part of your packet, that their readings of ours is artificially low. Well, if ours was artificially low, it certainly would be of the MPCA's also. And one of the folks that was involved in this coming up with this new testing method is actually here from Foth and Van Dyke, if there was any questions. But I can just real simply show you that, if you will, if you look at this chart, the two samples in the blue are what we came, our testing company came up with, PACE Laboratories, when they ran it as we asked them to, in accordance to it. If you then look at Dr. Townsend's test method, which totally gives you an accurate reading of dissolved sulfur, which is what causes hydrogen sulfide gases, when realistically, it's 10 times higher than that. So now you have a significant problem. So I guess what I'm saying is the test that we've performed, even as MPCA, isn't accurate of the total amount of hydrogen sulfide that's out there. So we've based the decision not on safety and going the extra, let's waver on the safe side instead of the when it's too late and we have deaths or what nuisances. Thanks, Ray. The other part is, as I said earlier, the difference between this going to a landfill and used as cover is attenuation. We use soil for attenuation. And many, many people have studied this. Again, Dr. Townsend printed a paper back in September of 2007 that clearly points out the importance of dilution as far as being able to attenuate hydrogen sulfide gases. He looked at other materials, too. He looked at concrete fines and some other compost. And Jana Jambach, a PhD from New Hampshire, an expert in this field, did the same. And this is really what we're kind of talking about. If you have soils, they can attenuate the we call it H2S, hydrogen sulfide gas. However, if you take that material and you now allow it as fines, you're not attenuating it. The only thing you're doing is you're actually building up the strength for it. And that's our problem. We would like to see, we feel it's absolutely necessary that the state adopt best management practices. Not knowing what those are, thus we introduced our bill of no gypsum, because that is the serious debate here. And again, it's a human health issue. It is no other issue. I don't want it to get diluted and polluted with all these other things, but it is a human health issue. We do have four deaths, and I guess we would hope that we would go on the safe side rather than pay later. Thank you, Chairman, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
Okay, questions for the witness? Seeing none, next witness.
We have another witness. Yeah, Mr.
Yes, good afternoon. My name is Bob Brickner. I'm Executive Vice President of Gershman, Brickner & Bratton. We're based in Fairfax, Virginia. and I've been professionally involved in the solid waste field my entire professional career, which dates back to 1972. I've spent the past 36 years working extensively in both public and private sector clients addressing their solid waste needs for collection through recycling and disposal. Since 1990, I've completed more than 130 projects dealing with construction waste and demolition debris around the United States and visited more than 100 C&D waste handling and recycling facilities across the country. My testimony, as well as the attachments to that, are in a Spirely Bond document, which I hope each of you have. I received a letter last Thursday from State Representative Atkins inviting me to give testimony today. And essentially that letter said that he hoped to see an unbiased and educated person on the topic. Well, I'd like to think that I serve both those purposes. The proper environmental handling of the waste materials that are generated by the activities associated with new construction, building renovations, and demolition projects has gained significant state and national interest, especially in the past 10 years. While the traditional residential waste and commercial waste infrastructure are pretty well formulated for municipal solid waste management, the more recent focus has been on C&D waste and reaching their hierarchical goals of reuse, recycling, and disposal. At times, having worked on this for almost 20 years, I've felt like Darwin roaming the Galapagos Islands looking for management theory and answers. Many unique state and even regional battlegrounds have developed over the past few years in the country pertaining to the acceptable management and treatment of C&D waste, and even more challenging, the reuse and recycling of sub-constituents materials, including gypsum wallboard and the C&D fines that John alluded to. But fortunately, unlike John the Baptist in the biblical wilderness, GBB is not alone in addressing reasoned solutions to the past, current, and future C&D issues. Research into the unique attributes of C&D waste, including activities ongoing at the University of Florida and the University of New Hampshire, with folks that John alluded to earlier, are intense at this time, especially in problematic waste streams like gypsum wallboard and H2S production. The universe of C&D waste constituents covers a broad spectrum of materials. You can look around this room, and everything you can see has the potential to be a constituent of a demolition project sometime in the distant future, I hope. Real distant. We did a major study, probably the biggest one in the United States, about 10 years ago, where we spent 3 weeks and hand-sorted over 160 tons of construction demolition waste. We were able to identify about 5% of that material as gypsum wallboard, but more importantly, 29% of the material wasn't identified because it was too small to even put into a constituent material class. According to the Northeast Recycling Council, there's an estimated 14 million tons of waste gypsum generated each year. And due to the ability of gypsum wallboard to be converted into hydrogen sulfide, which at even very low levels presents a foul, rotten egg smell, each ton of scrap wallboard must be managed in an acceptable environmental and regulatory manner. I have read the PCA stakeholders package titled C&D Fines as Cover Material, which was dated February 21st, and I reviewed all of their attachments. I would like to say to the staff of MPCA, I know some of them are here, that they're to be congratulated on having done their own independent research in this area, as well as providing a forum for the stakeholders to make inquiries of the subject matter. However, I don't think that the MPCA has gone far enough to actually dictate the acceptable methodology to be used in creating the C&D fines in the first place for eventual utilization. Much like DNA, and before that fingerprints, No ones are essentially identical, and similarly, not all materials are generally characterized as C&D fines are similar either in composition or chemistry, let alone being handled in the same way at any given landfill. 15 to 20 years ago, C&D fines were screened dirt products. Nothing wrong with screened dirt products. That is not what C&D fines are today that are being used at landfills. 10 years ago, in 1999, at a meeting in Boston, an organized meeting that was put together by the Construction Materials Recycling Association, a discussion occurred with respect to C&D fines. Ultimately, that discussion was paraphrased in a Construction Materials Recycling magazine, and fines were defined as follows. A byproduct of recycling C&D is a large number of fines, usually quarter-inch minus. There currently are limited markets and uses for the materials. If properly applied, the fines can be used as alternative daily cover, ADC as it's called, a very competitive marketplace. In addition, so much fines material is generated that large amounts still would have to be dumped into landfills. The landfill's entire solid waste stream could just be fines. It's just a matter of what the operators want in their landfills. Now, it's the last sentence of this quote that causes problems for me, and I think the crux of the situation being discussed today regarding the generation and the acceptability of C&D fines. More specifically, the issue is the level of generation of gypsum wallboard that's in the fines and the potential for the breakdown of this material to generate very hazardous and at times deadly hydrogen sulfide. One of the early known documents produced in 1998 by Tim Townsend, a noted professor and researcher in C&D that John alluded to earlier, stated the following. The success of most C&D materials recovery facilities is largely contingent upon the availability of viable reuse markets. However, the reuse of recovered waste materials must maintain regard for human health and the environment through compliance with existing regulations and the policies for solid waste management. Additionally, in a follow-up article in 2005, Mr. Thompson noted that hydrogen sulfide emissions have been demonstrated as ongoing nuisances at some construction and demolition waste landfills. So they are not just confined to MSW landfills. He also indicated that the study demonstrated that the presence of cover soils alone could effectively reduce hydrogen sulfide emissions relative to their uncovered conditions. So essentially, the mixing of regular dirt soil with this material is better than just applying this hydrogen sulfide-based C&D fines on the landfill itself. I find it interesting that in the PCA document that I read from last month, Addendum 1 alluded to the March 1999 PCA authorization for Steele County, which allowed the use of demolition debris grindings in ADC if it was mixed at a 1-to-1 ratio with soil. The same paragraph identified concerns with ADC, and it was ultimately suspended after 3 years due to a private contractor was not adequately removing asbestos and non-demolition debris materials. This illustrates to me that at least 10 years ago, PCA was aware of at least some form of C&D ADC required and should presumed beneficial mixing with traditional soil cover and not used 100% as just ADC fines. And that there was deleterious material in the ADC. At that time, it was asbestos. Now we're talking about gypsum wallboard that could be a harmful material. Over the past 5 to 7 years, the C&D industry, in particular C&D recyclers' interests, have benefited by increased state regulations associated with all landfills, municipal as well as C&D landfills. And there are certain ordinances, especially in the state of California, their municipalities have passed, that are looking to deliver construction waste and demolition debris to C&D recycling facilities from the get-go and not allowing that material without recycling to be landfilled. Many groups, including the state of New Hampshire and the state of Massachusetts, have implemented best management practices for the handling of alternative daily cover and handling gypsum wallboard in general before it actually gets processed. Some of these standards and methods have included the gypsum removal prior to the processing or transferring the material from the get-go, eliminating it from households as part of the waste stream, having it source separated, much like most of you might be using blue bins or source separating bins for your own household recyclables, and keeping the material out of the C&D waste stream, or mixing the ADC with soils, etc. Very nice PowerPoint presentation by a gentleman from the Massachusetts DEP was available on the internet discussing the problems of the state of Massachusetts, one of the leading states in addressing ADC fines with gypsum wallboard. Is presented in your package. It's attachment 4, and it's well worth your reading pleasure and looking at the pictures as well as the words associated with that. But on slide 38, they present the best management practices that have been developed for some of the sites in the state of Massachusetts, and I encourage you to review that. One of the principals of the firm that has done a bunch of research for the Construction Materials Recycling Association and contracted to help them develop their own best management practices wrote in March of 2006 in an article that the manufacturing methods of C&D fines, and thus the makeup of the product, varies depending upon the facility producing it and the specific state or local regulations enacted enforcing the specifications. C&D fines are produced by the additional waste handling and breakage at transfer stations, which are one of the producing methods or facilities that are allowed to generate the ADC now going to the permitted landfills. And the more handling that you have with wallboard and processing and the dropping it, picking it up, munching it with front-end loaders and excavators, et cetera, at these facility sites, breaks up this very friable material into the small fines fraction. My opinion of the events ongoing regarding the management of C&D fines as ADC at the two subject landfills that have been permitted in Minnesota is that the current MPCA rules do not, as I said earlier, go far enough to reduce the potential for environmental degradation of these sites. The current research into the subject, both at the University of Florida and University of New Hampshire, is aimed at developing additional dilution formulas where either soil, compost, wood, coal ash, or other materials would be mixed with the C&D fines prior to application. That seems reasonable to conclude as a good and best management practice. Therefore, in summary, my independent objective opinion regarding C&D fines is that the PCA needs to take more immediate and aggressive action to develop specific best management practices to control this material by the key wallboard generators, which could be the drywallers themselves and the collectors, if possible, and at the specific C&D processing sources making the intended product. Doing this by working within the entire industry group of stakeholders to tweak the system, so to speak, to promote more specific approaches to allow collection and segregation of gypsum wallboard materials before excessive quantities become integrated and identifiable within the general C&D waste stream is in everybody's best interest. However, as it pertains to the current bill, and most importantly for the committee hearing today, I also am realistic and know that due to the nature of demolition, renovation activity, and new construction waste stream, it is neither practical nor technically feasible to to provide a gypsum-free C&D Fines product. I feel it is important to acknowledge that C&D Fines can play a vital role in reducing the use of virgin soil as a cover product at our nation's landfills, and this can provide a product marketplace for almost 25% to 30% of the C&D waste stream if produced as an ADC product. The issue is solely the gypsum wallboard. I thank you for giving me an opportunity to present my thoughts and industry information for your consideration. Pardon me?
What's the acronym ADC?
Alternative daily cover. It's in lieu of dirt on a landfill.
Senator Olson?
I was looking at your the best management practices put forward in the PowerPoint presentation and noted that the bill is very narrow in terms of its focus of the solution. But I believe you came close to addressing the fact that's a good place to start, is to just to avoid using it as cover at this point rather than to try to pursue all of the other options that would seem to be best management practices.
Well,
Mr. Brinkley.
I think it's important to acknowledge, even if you had a bill like that that's on the table at the moment, you won't be able to keep all the gypsum wallboard out. The intent is the amount of gypsum wallboard that gets generated and finds its way into the construction demolition material waste stream, and trying to address and keep that out of there for any facilities that are going to grind it or screen it, mainly screen the material, and then it becomes part of the chemical composition of the dirt-like fraction, then goes as a cover material. It hasn't been shown to be a significant problem at regular landfills when it's mixed with other types of materials on a day-to-day basis. But if it's segregated and becomes a high percentage in a concentrated form through this screening process at these transfer stations and recycling facilities and becomes a cover material where moisture gets on it, et cetera, then it does become a problem.
So Mr. Chairman, just following up.
Wilson. So
did I hear you just suggest that the handling of that gypsum wallboard would be better in just a regular landfill rather than concentrated in a construction and demolition site, particularly if it's ground up and
what I was indicating is that for years the wallboard has been part of a broader C&D waste stream, and therefore it's a small percent, 2-4%, and it's mixed throughout the landfill. That is less of a problem than in a concentrated stream where you screen the fines, the gypsum fines, and a large percentage of the fines are a big part of this alternative daily cover material. That in a high concentration being the top part of the landfill, the cover, if you will, that's when it becomes a problem as opposed to being sprinkled all over the landfill.
So, Mr. Chair,
why isn't that a problem? Doesn't moisture get into the landfill as well?
Yeah, it's significantly diluted, and you don't have the surface.
2-3% adds up after a while, and moisture certainly gets in there. Why not address the general landfill of sheetrock issue as well? Senator Metzen.
I understand what you're saying, and we'd like a full loaf of bread here today, but I don't think we're going to get there. But if we could make a significant start in this area, I think it's really in the right direction. And this isn't a cure-all for everything, but I think it's a heck of a good start. And once in a while, the MPC could be wrong in some of this stuff. You've heard from two people here that really know this inside out and backwards, and there's other alternatives to cover the landfills out there, and probably even less expensive, if you will. Why not do that? So we think there are other methods to do this, and if indeed this hydrogen sulfide, according to our experts, is present, it's terrible. It's a terrible situation. And if indeed these four people from Superior, Wisconsin, died from this, we don't want that to happen in the state of Minnesota. And some counties are prohibiting it now, including the county I come from, Dakota County. So there's reasons out there, and I think you've heard some good reasons why we should not allow this. And we're going to hear from the MPC, and I don't know what their defense is going to be. I'd be curious to listen to how they can defend using this product that has been proven to be harmful.
I think the question is, if it's harmful, where should we put the sheetrock then?
I think I have to let the expert speak, but I think it's a matter of diluting all of these things, and it's too concentrated the way it's going on now as a cover.
I think that right now, for instance, at our landfills, we do have fines. There is gypsum in it. We don't break it up even further. We do run compaction equipment over it, but we don't screen it, then do it. And so you don't have the concentration. But the biggest and single most difference is we do put soils down as cover material. The soils attenuate the movement of the H2S, where if you're just doing it in more cover of gypsum, you're just adding to the problem. As the diagram illustrated, there's nothing to dilute it or to attenuate it. It just keeps moving. And not to say that our landfills may not have an H2S problem someday. Knock on woods, we have not yet. And gypsum is an issue that probably should be tackled on a much larger scale. I agree, Mr. Chairman, but I do agree with Senator Metz, and we're starting here now.
Senator Olson, and then we'll hear from PCA.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, again, looking at your the pictures and things here, has this come about more with the grinding up in order to increase the capacity of the construction debris so that you have these fines, number one? And number two, it's still, I think the chair has asked the question too. One of the best management practices is wallboard separation program required. Well, what do you do with that? I haven't heard anything said that if you were to separate it at all and do something else with it, what is that something else that would be advisable to do with waste wallboard?
Okay, there's probably 10 to 15 different facilities around the United States that use scrap wallboard and gypsum that is recycled from facilities, including the remanufacturing of wallboard, but obviously you need a wallboard manufacturing plant nearby to move that material into. Okay. So there's a lot of different alternatives out there. It typically has become the economics and what is marketable in the region where you live, where you are. I don't know exactly what the makeup is of market options for drywall in this particular state, but I definitely encourage a review of that as a possible way to mitigate it from the source, much like you do newspapers, cans, bottles, glass, et cetera, et cetera.
Thank you. Further questions for the witnesses? Mr. Rodas from PCA. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Mr. Rodas, what is the PCA's position on construction debris and residue as cover material?
Sure. I can maybe walk you through a little bit of the history that the agency's had on this issue, just to try to maybe address some of the questions that have been raised in the testimony today. We've had experience with this issue going back about 18 months, which was when we were first approached with using this particular type of
alternative. I apologize for interrupting. This is Leo Rodas from the PCA.
Thank you. So about 18 months ago, we were asked to look at whether we would approve the use of this material as alternative daily cover in a couple different situations, at demo landfills and industrial waste landfills. And we did issue approvals to do that. So we've had quite a bit of experience. We've seen this practice being employed at a landfill up in Buffalo for 18 months now without any incident. We haven't had any trouble. Recently, back fall of last year, we were approached by some stakeholders who were concerned about the continuation of this practice and asked us to take another look at it. So we did that. We did a literature review. We went and talked to all the different states in the country that that either use or have some concerns about using this material in landfills, gathered all that information, did our own independent analysis of the material itself to make sure we really understood what was in there to see if there were any concerns. Because as the previous testifiers had stated, hydrogen sulfide gas is a very serious potential health concern. It's something that the agency takes very, very seriously in a number of different areas. Any industrial waste landfill has the potential to create hydrogen sulfide gas, no matter how you cover the material. And in fact, the horribly tragic incident that occurred in Wisconsin was, I think, a reminder of how we all need to be very, very careful in industrial settings and how we deal with hydrogen sulfide gas. My understanding of what happened in that case was there were four workers who went into a confined space situation and didn't have appropriate ventilation and were very, very quickly overcome and died from the gas. Very, very different situation from what we're talking about here, which is how much gas is emitted from the way you cover an industrial waste landfill and what are the potential public health implications. So very, very different situation. We certainly wouldn't expect anybody to be in a confined space situation dealing with the way you cover a demolition landfill. But so we did do quite a bit of work late last year and wrapped it up early this year to make sure that what we were doing and what we were allowing was protective from an environmental and public health standpoint. Again, we've seen this practice being employed for 18 months at a landfill in Buffalo, haven't had any problems whatsoever, and they've been inspected about on a monthly basis.
How long would it normally take to see a problem? Would it take longer than 18 months to see a problem if it did occur?
You know, and speaking with our professional engineering staff who are experts in solid waste issues, what they tell me is we would have seen something at this point already if there was going to be a problem. You can't always precisely predict exactly what kind of climatic conditions are going to create a particular problem, but we're heartened by the fact that 18 months have gone by and for us the outcomes have been pretty solid. I think the additional work that we did late last year, the analysis that we contracted an independent lab to do of the material itself reassured us that there are very, very low levels of gypsum contained. I personally visited the recycling facility that generates this material and saw how it was created. It's a very passive system. Basically, it's sort of the dirt and just sort of basic stuff that falls out of a construction process. It's not something that's created specifically. It's just sort of the gunk that you end up with at the end of the day when you're doing a demo project. So we did all this analysis and ultimately concluded that we were satisfied that the hydrogen sulfide issue was not an issue to be concerned about here. What we did is we reaffirmed our decision by having the commissioner sign a new decision. And what that decision actually does is it puts some very specific parameters on where we think it's acceptable to continue to employ this practice. And a couple of different things are very, very important to key in on. One is that we will continue not to allow this practice on municipal solid waste landfills. And these are sort of the garden variety, take all the garbage from the households, facilities. And the reason we don't want to allow it in those facilities is that you have a lot of organics, and the organic content is something that could be problematic and could create high levels of hydrogen sulfide gas. In the 20 states that we found that do allow this and are seeing the use of ADC fines as cover, they actually allow it in municipal solid waste landfills. Some of them have problems. Most of them don't. But we just didn't feel like it was worth taking a chance, and we're just going to stick with demolition landfills and industrial waste landfills. And we thought that was a very, very conservative but appropriate thing to do. The second thing we did in this decision is we wanted to make sure that we did not allow anybody to crush material to create ADC fines. The concern there is that if you're having people crush waste to create fines to be used as cover, you don't know what's going in there unless you're watching it all the time. So we would have concerns about people putting in high levels of gypsum-containing material. Actually, the reason that we decided to move away from allowing crushing a couple years ago was we visited a site as they were doing the crushing, and one of the workers tossed a TV into the crusher. Obviously, that's not the kind of thing that we want to see happening, so we decided to continue not to allow that. So the decision that we made was to continue to allow this practice that's been going on for 18 months with some very specific conditions. And those conditions we consider to be best management practices. Of course, those can always be improved upon. But we think that they lay out fairly good conditions, conservative, stringent conditions for the use of this material. Importantly, we only allow this in situations where we actually permit not only the generator of the material. So in this case, there are a couple of recycling facilities that end up with this material. So we permit them so we know exactly how it's being generated, so there's no crushing going on, there's no monkey business going on. It's just actually a passive byproduct. And we also permit the landfill who's going to accept it to make sure that they accept it and use it in an acceptable manner. Having said that, you know, if it's the legislature's will to move forward on a bill like this, we would, of course, implement it to the best of our abilities. I would imagine that responsibility would fall to the agency because we do permit landfills and recycling facilities, and we would do so to the best of our abilities.
What about this concentration issue? Is there a point in time where there will be enough laid down as cover that it could be an issue?
Mr. Chair, members, we don't believe so because the way our engineers explained it to me is that you basically, when you use this as a cover, it'll stay on there, but it will start to degrade over time. So it starts, as the material is sitting on there, it starts to sort of trickle into the landfill and ends up in the landfill as if it were just disposed of. We haven't seen any problems with the concentration. There may be more concerns, as one of the members pointed out, about accepting gypsum-containing material like wallboard, where you have fairly large concentrations in big chunks sitting inside of a landfill. That may be an issue worth looking into a little bit further. But as far as this goes, again, we haven't seen a problem, and our analysis really doesn't indicate that we will see a problem.
Further questions for the witness? None. Reed Lewis. Thank you, Mr. Rodas. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Reed Lewis. I represent Broadway Resource Recovery and Atomic Recycling, two affiliated companies that specialize in construction, demolition, waste recycling, otherwise known as C&D. We are located approximately 3 miles north of the IDS building in downtown Minneapolis. The facility has 26 to 30 full-time employees. In 2007, Broadway Resource Recovery processed over 107,000 tons of commingled C&D waste. Of the 107,000 tons processed, we recycled over 67,000 tons, or 63% by weight, or the equivalent of 64 miles of dumpsters put end to end. In 2006, our facility processed and recycled more commingled construction waste than all other transfer stations and landfills combined in the 10-county metro area. The different commodities we recycle from the commingled waste stream are wood, steel, aggregate, cardboard, and C&D fines. C&D fines are a real material. It is not manufactured, but rather it is just the material that is found at the bottom of a dumpster. I have here a sample of the C&D fines. Is there a way I can pass that around as a sample?
Sure. Yeah.
I also have a letter that I'd like to have passed around.
We'll pass it out.
Thank you. You can go ahead and that jar, so to speak, has had this C&D screen fines in it for a number of months. You can go ahead and open it and smell it if you'd like. It smells like dirt or dirt-like material.
I'll take your word for it.
All right. The method that we have always used in the recovery of C&D fines at our facility has been screening. This is done by having the C&D waste go over a 2-inch screen specifically designed to remove the fines from the waste stream. We do not grind the C&D waste to create fines, as some have suggested. I would like to point out that the state supports separation and reuse of this material per Minnesota Statute 115A.02, which, among other things, requires separation and recovery of material, and also clearly states that recycling is the preference of the state over landfilling waste. Also, the MPCA Program Management Decision Memorandum dated February 20th, 2008, which approved CND fines as cover on a case-by-case basis. Finally, the use of CND fines as ADC preserves a virgin, non-renewable resource aggregate. We also operate Atomic Recycling, the second largest fleet of roll-off dumpster trucks that collect the CND waste from around the 10-county metro area and transport the waste to our facility in Minneapolis for processing and recycling. We were made aware of this meeting only last Friday. In that very short period of time, we have attempted to fly in recognized experts in the field of CND fines as ADC, as well as the director of the industry trade group Construction Materials Recycling Association. In a recent letter, the director states that a wholesale ban on gypsum and gypsum residue is not the approach that should be taken. Also, in this very short period of time, a letter from the billion-dollar-a-year developer and associated general contractor member, Ryan Companies, to the state Senate outlining how this bill would negatively affect Ryan Companies and the construction industry in general. To quote from the letter from Ryan Companies, "We all want a more sustainable Minnesota. As well-intentioned as this bill may be, it will take us in exactly the opposite direction. Because of that, we respectfully request that you withdraw your support from this bill. If this bill is going to be heard again, we would appreciate advance notice to allow enough time to schedule the director of the CMRA and experts in the field of CND fines as cover material to testify. In closing, I would like to extend an invitation to anyone from the state to tour our facility and see firsthand how recycling all construction and demolition debris benefits the state and its sustainable guidelines."
So, questions for the witness, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, a couple of them. One, in that particular container, what proportion of that would you say would be the fines from the from Wallboard?
The testing from Pace Analytical is found within the report from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
So, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Lewis, you know that better than I know. I don't have that report in front of me. So what do you have any idea what that is?
I'm looking over to Jeff Strack. The question is, what percent of?
But the stuff in that jar, what proportion of that would be the?
Wallboard is 5.1%.
And that's 5.1% in that jar, or is that essentially of your overall waste stream?
Yes, that was the 10 samples taken from our facility and analyzed by Pace Analytical. I do not know what percent is found within that jar.
So, and Mr. Chairman, the other question I have is, you talked about processing. When you get this debris, and you said recycling, could you describe how you recycle, what kinds of uses that debris is put to when it comes in, or where does it go when it leaves your plant?
Of course.
Mr. Reed.
Well, our wood is ground to a specified, through a specified screen, and currently, based on the time of the year, what we do with that is we ship it to a company in Benson, Minnesota, and what they do with it is they mix it with turkey manure, and the wood removes the moisture from the turkey manure, and then the composite is gasified and burned as waste to energy. Our steel is sent directly to the local steel mill, Gerdau Ameristeel. Our aggregate material is sent about 8 miles down the road to Maple Grove to C.S. McCrossin, where they crush it and use it as recycled class 5. Our cardboard is shipped about 2 miles away to a Pioneer Paper, where they put it in with the rest of their cardboard and ship it off.
And how about the wallboard?
Yes, so, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry. There's what's called landfill residual. The balance of our waste stream is sent to the landfill, approximately 35%, and in that is wallboard.
So wallboard in itself is not really recyclable, or is it?
The closest, it is recyclable. There's a plant, but not here geographically, locally, it's not. There's a plant, the closest plant for recycled drywall is in Boston, Massachusetts. They charge, I spoke to the plant manager there, they charge $60 a ton to accept new construction drywall. They do not accept existing or renovated drywall. That's because they charge $60 a ton because the local landfills there for construction and demolition waste charge $93 a ton. So that's the market there. The closest market we've seen for other types of applications is in Pennsylvania, where they grind it up as a soil amendment, and they've been in business for about 10 or 12 years. There's a mine in Iowa where they actually mine the gypsum where it's manufactured and shipped here.
So, Mr. Chairman,
awesome.
Mr. Chairman, so is your company the primary source of the fines that are being used for the covering of in the construction and demolition landfills now?
It's our facility and another.
In Minnesota?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay. I'm seeing a nod from the PCA, yes. Okay. Further questions for the witness? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Senator Metzen.
Chairman, members, the PCA said if we pass this bill, they can enforce it. I would say there's no harm in passing this bill, but there could be a lot of harm in not passing this bill. I'm not a scientist, and I don't profess to have all those kind of answers, but I would think that an 18-month window in any scientific approach to things, it just seems to me as a long enough true and tried term to determine if indeed we're causing hydrogen sulfide gas into our system, and none of us want that. And it's not like there's not alternatives to this. There's a lot of alternatives. You don't need this. You don't need this for the cover. And if there's any doubt in your minds at this table, if there's even a doubt, which I have doubts, you should pass this legislation because it's enforceable and there are other alternatives to this kind of cover. I've got one short, if another minute. I know you're busy, yet, but I've got the gentleman from Dakota County that wanted to visit with us just very briefly. Jeff Harthen, the Director of Environmental Management from Dakota County, has a few short remarks.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Hartoon. I'm the Director of Dakota County's Environmental Management Department. Dakota County takes more waste as landfill material than any other county in the state. Therefore, understandably, we have a keen interest in these types of issues. Been with Dakota County for 22 years. I've pretty much visited every waste facility in the state of Minnesota as a result of my time at Dakota County, previous time with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I personally observed situations that Mr. Domke and others have referenced, the rotten egg smell at facilities. I don't know the situation, the specifics of the Superior, Wisconsin situation, but I, since it was a confined space, I suspect it was something revolving around situations that I've observed from time to time when landfills have to be redug, as I call it. And usually that happens if there's a problem waste that went into a facility, which routinely happens at industrial waste sites. Has to be dug up, or in some cases fires occur and people have to enter this confined space, if you will. That would be, I guess, my biggest concern with concentrating too much of this material in a landfill, and I would opt for certainly trying to recycle this material as much as possible, but given the the markets and geography of the situation that we've heard here today and so forth, perhaps a better interim solution would be mixing it, as has been mentioned, as much as possible with as much soil as possible to minimize the concerns of this problem from occurring and impacting a health situation. In addition to that, the senator to my left also indicated that Dakota County does not allow this material. Just to elaborate on that for 1 minute, Dakota County doesn't allow any cover material other than soil and soil types of materials on landfills unless it's specifically approved on a case-by-case basis. What we do allow now are things such as tarps, some type of artificial foam for daily cover on municipal landfills in the county, but mostly it's just soils, and we believe that's the safest way to go. And in addition to the health concerns that they've raised about this material, I'm not sure that enough has been looked at to, as far as the physical characteristics of this material, we don't really believe it makes that good of a cover material. It's porous, it's dusty. There are some physical needs for cover material that you would like that go beyond simply whether or not you can physically put it on a landfill or whether it does or doesn't present health concerns. So I'd like to just raise that as an issue as well, and that's another reason why Dakota County has chosen not to allow this material pursuant to its solid waste ordinance, which the county board has adopted.
So you're saying you detect the sulfur just from landfills that have wallboard in them?
Yeah. Last summer I was at a landfill that you could clearly easily smell the rotten egg odor. I was at a landfill in Burnsville, actually. And I've noticed that from time to time in other landfills, too, especially during hot, humid weather.
Senator Olson, and
yeah,
I think we should wrap this up.
I'm trying to separate some things I've heard. You're talking about all landfills, municipal solid waste and construction and demolition. I think of those as two separate things, and I thought the issue we were talking about here was primarily the construction and demolition. If I heard correctly from Mr. Raddatz from the PCA, you don't allow these fines for use in covering municipal solid waste. It was only for the construction and demolition debris that did not have ground up gypsum wallboard as the underlying base.
Mr. Hartung?
Mr. Chair.
Is that correct?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, that is what's being considered now. When the PCA initially started looking at this issue, it is my understanding that everything was on the table and they've taken a more narrow focus at this point, just as of last week when they came out with their policy that they're now going to allow this material to be used only on industrial and demolition landfills and only the fines. Previously, they were looking at using it perhaps at other types of landfills, specifically mixed municipal landfills, and also there was talk about the ground-up material, in other words, grinding up demolition debris to use that. They backed off of that and narrowed the focus, and I think probably for the health concerns that have been raised on this issue.
So, Mr. Chair, could I ask Mr. Raddatz another question?
Sure. Mr. Raddatz, would you approach?
Plain to say no, but I don't.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Raddatz, is that correct that this policy has just come about in the last week? That change to limiting it to the construction and demolition?
Mr. Raddatz.
Madam Chair, Senator, what we... It's important to remember that the only permits we issued to do this back 18 months ago was just for construction, demolition, industrial waste facilities. So that's been our practice for some time. In the report that we prepared in response to all the stakeholder concerns from last year, they provided a number of concerns. I mean, I think the document is about this thick, so it took us a while to get through it. We have really carefully considered where we want to go with this. I'd say our position is not all that different from where it was 18 months ago. I think we have we understand with more precision where we want to allow this and where we don't. But we want to make sure we reiterated to the community that none of this happens without our prior approval.
And one more question, Mr. Chairman. During that 18-month period, and when you've been monitoring where this has been used, so that it hasn't caused any problem, what do you mean by monitoring? Do you have some measurement? Are there probes? Are there some metered, ways to determine whether any of this hydrogen sulfide is present, or how do you determine that? And monitor after, with a period of time after heavy rainfalls that would seem to give time for generation of that gas?
Mr. Ruddis.
Mr. Chair, Senator, like with all landfills, we don't specifically monitor to that degree. That's a fairly expensive proposition. Actually, our best monitoring on a landfill like that, and in this one in particular, are the residents that are very nearby. The folks that live around this community have historically been around this landfill have been very, very actively engaged on this landfill and are very, very quick to call us with complaints that we follow up on with inspections. We have received no complaints in the 18 months that we've been doing this or allowing them to do this this particular practice. We also have an arrangement with the county where they visit this landfill very frequently. They visit about once every month and, again, have seen no problem. So hydrogen sulfide gas, it's the sort of thing that was described earlier, is that when you have the smell, it's fairly easy to detect. People complain very, very rapidly. And when you're talking about hydrogen sulfide getting in sort of the ambient air in the neighborhood, it doesn't take very long for folks to give us a call and let us know that something's up. We haven't had that problem in this situation.
Senator Metzen, last word.
Well, I don't think the PCA has made a compelling reason not to pass this bill. They said they could monitor it, and there is just as reasonably priced alternatives to capping these as this product that most of us should be doubtful about. And if you have any doubts in your mind, like I think I do, and you should, I think, why allow this to continue? You could put regular dirt and gravel and other means on top of this instead of this product, and it's proven to be safer. So I would suggest that you vote for this legislation. The PCA said they could monitor it. There's no need for this, in my opinion.
Senator Metzen, in this committee, any bill that does not need to be seen by another committee is being laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus policy bill. So that's what we will do with Senate file.
That's fine, but I want to thank you. I know it got a little lengthy, no, but as you can
right,
tell,
thank
this
you.
Is very, very important situation here. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Next item on the agenda is Senate File 2800, Senator Anderson.
About it. I'd rather have you here. I'm not going to say a lot.
Okay.
He'll show up. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 2800 relates to recycling of plastic bags. This was a bill that was brought to me by my House member, I've since heard, after talking to a lot of people about it, that a lot of people have pet peeves. Maybe that's the wrong word, but are really kind of sick of how many plastic bags there are floating around in our environment. What I have learned is that Minnesotans use approximately 2.8 billion plastic bags each year. That's just Minnesotans. It's really kind of hard to believe. It's a staggering number. But if you think about it, every time you go to the store and buy something, you get plastic bags and you get things in plastic bags. And many of us try to reuse them for various purposes and also try to recycle them, but we're still kind of overwhelmed with them. And, you know, I've gotten to the point where I just try not to take bags at the store anymore, but you really have to plan ahead and think about it. So we need to have mechanisms in place to get all of us to have better habits about our waste use. And plastic bags are really important because they're made from petroleum products, generally. And so it's a resource that we know is limited and a resource that we know contributes to our environmental problems. So given that something like 80% of our groceries now come in plastic bags, and that's probably how most of us do most of our shopping is when we go to the grocery store, it seems that it's time we start looking at some limitations on our use of these bags. A lot of cities, countries, states are starting to regulate plastic bag usage. I have a list. California, which tends to pass a lot of these laws first, became the first state to initiate a mandatory recycling program aimed at plastic shopping bags. And this bill is modeled largely after their law. New York City's implemented mandatory collection and recycling of plastic bags. South Africa, India, Israel, Ireland, Switzerland, Taiwan, and Belgium all charge money for plastic bags by law. And China, Bangladesh, Tanzania, and San Francisco are banning plastic bags. There's a lot of activity in this area. I thought that this bill was a reasonable approach that allows us to try to take responsibility ourselves and to share responsibility for trying to reduce our waste and handle it more responsibly. So let me just tell you briefly how the bill would work, and then I have some testifiers who can talk about it from their expertise. Essentially, the bill would affect any store that's over 5,000 square feet or one of a chain of stores that has five or more stores in the state. And all of anyone who fits under those categories of a store, a fairly large store, would have to have a collection bin and collect plastic bags at the store site so that bags that are returned by consumers can have a place to be deposited, and then the store owner would have the responsibility to put the bin up and to ensure that those bags do get recycled. We also require stores to make reusable bags available to consumers. Now, I know that a lot of stores are already doing both of those things, especially in the metropolitan area. We require the store to maintain a record of how much bags or how many bags by weight that they're collecting, and to just report that information to the Pollution Control Agency so we can start to get a handle on the magnitude of this waste issue. The bill also requires that manufacturers take responsibility for their production and distribution of the bags, the manufacturers who make these bags, who manufacture them. And we have not been able to be in contact with a manufacturer of plastic bags. None of them have contacted me at this point. What the manufacturers would have to do under this bill is to pick up and recycle the bags at the store's request. And then if they do that pickup and recycling, then they would be the ones that would report the amount of bags by weight to the PCA. We also require the manufacturers, after a period of time, a transition period, to label bags, put a label on it that says, please reuse or recycle on every bag that is distributed at a store. And we also ask the manufacturers to provide educational materials. There's some civil penalties that are in the bill, and that is essentially what's in the bill. I've had a lot of discussion through my staff in particular with different people who work in areas related to recycling and retail stores, And we've learned some things that make it difficult in some parts of the state to collect and recycle plastic bags. And we'll have a little bit of discussion about whether this is something that we can do statewide. But first, I'd like to start with testimony from Susan Hubbard, who really is our recycling expert in the Twin Cities. Susan is from Eureka Recycling, correct?
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, committee members. It's my pleasure to be here today. Put this back in here. Eureka Recycling is a nonprofit recycling organization. Right now, we're serving over 1 million people in Minnesota, providing direct recycling services. We've been recycling for a couple of decades. We're about an $8 million organization. We have around 100 employees. We run over 40 trucks down the road, and we have a very large material recovery facility that's a recycling center. And sometimes that acronym is the word that people use is MRF. And so that's the kind of operation that we run. We also do education and advocacy. So today I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the issue around plastic bags and the recyclability. There are over 100 billion plastic bags. That's just the shopping bags. This is not garbage bags. And it's really important to understand we're just talking about shopping bags here. They're purchased annually in the United States by these retail stores. And this represents about 330 bags per person. This also equals around 12 million barrels of oil. So that's the size of the issue that we have at hand. And then with 330 bags per person and 12 million barrels of oil, less than 1% of these plastic shopping bags are currently being recycled. And they're more than ever being recycled, but it's still way less than 1%. So the idea is, where are these things getting produced, and why are there so many of them? And I think some interesting things for people to know is that, for example, in India alone, 5,000 processing plants are producing plastic bags right now. And in Kenya, there are 4,000 tons of plastic bags created a month. So and those are just a couple of places that are creating these bags. And these bags have economic, health, and environmental costs and benefits. We've all used plastic bags. I've used plastic bags. And the mission of the organization that I run is to demonstrate that waste is completely preventable. But there's the reality when you hit the road at the grocery store without your bag. So while offering advantages like flexibility and reduced weight, they also create problems, including the consumption of fossil fuels and, as I mentioned before, 12 billion barrels of oil. They also use a tremendous amount of energy just to create them. They create pollution in the form of blowing litter. And this is something that we're hearing more and more about, and people are really upset about the plastic bags that are blowing in the trees and the blight it is on the community. But I think more serious than that is the emissions when they're burnt in the incinerators, and also the issues upon their degradation in landfills or in the environment. Because what happens with these plastic bags is that they do not biodegrade. There is not one piece of plastic on the planet that has yet been around long enough to biodegrade. What's happened is it's photodegraded, and it's photodegraded to the point that it's small. It's a nanoparticle. It's smaller than 1/60th of a human hair. It's very small particles, and that's really what's happened to plastic at this point in the environment. And basically, when plastic gets that small, it accumulates in the food chain, and eventually then it ends up in us because we're at the top of that food chain. And plastic, right now, they're finding out more and more what is happening to human beings when they're exposed to plastic, and certainly it's been proven scientifically, and it's widely accepted that plastics are endocrine disruptors. And it's also widely accepted that as a pollution prevention and a precautionary step is to make sure that plastics aren't ingested. And there's all kinds of legislation banning certain plastics from baby toys and baby bottles, et cetera. So plastics in the environment is a big issue, and this is why. The issue is because not one piece of plastic that was created in the last 50 years has left the planet. Not one particle of plastic that we've ever created in 50 years has left the planet. It's still here. And it will be here, and they predict, for several thousand years. And that's what the scientists are saying. According to Dr. Anthony Andretti, he's a senior research scientist at North Carolina's Research Triangle, every bit of plastic manufactured in the world for the last 50 years or so still remains somewhere in our environment. So now, why don't we pick them up at the curb and recycle them? That's what I would be thinking. So I will try to answer that for you, because that's what we do, is pick stuff up at the curb. Most curbside recycling programs in the country, they don't collect this or allow residents to put the plastic bags in with the recyclables, because the process that we use to sort out these materials, basically in preparation to sell these to manufacturers, because obviously we're turning stuff into the raw feedstock for a manufacturing process. And these plastic bags have a lot of problems. Number one, the sorting equipment that we use in these recycling facilities, they don't take this sort of, they call it linear, this film. It gets jammed up in the machines and it causes breakdowns. It's an absolute nightmare in terms of operations. You can't handle it. But secondly, the film, in order for it to be recycled, has to be extremely clean. And our MRF is one of the cleanest, I think, in the state. There's only a handful of MRFs, and that's material recovery facility. So when we talk about material coming in and going out, like in the last presentation, we talked about, you know, 100% of the material coming in, and they were recycling, I think, 60% or 40%. I can't remember which variation it was. In our facility, 99% of the material that comes in gets recycled. So it's a very clean facility. And yet the standards that are required for plastic bag recycling are so stringent that it would be very difficult to mix that up with your bottles and cans and deliver the kind of plastic film that these markets would want. So there's challenges not only in the processing, but there's challenges in finding a market that would buy it unless it was in a very clean condition. And just to top that off, because we live in the world of reality, our organization doesn't take any subsidies at all for our operations. We completely earn the money that we operate on, because our goal is to demonstrate that a green company like this could exist. And so to say that, and then to say, is it economically even viable for a company to drive around and pick up this stuff? And the answer is absolutely not. There has to be a chain of responsibility along the way that is going to pay for the cost of recycling this. This right now, there are some programs happening in the state that you'll hear about, and they're being subsidized by grants and by companies like Target, et cetera, who are voluntarily trying to step forward. But there isn't the type of involvement from the manufacturers and the retailers and the consumers that are, it's even coming close to stemming this problem. And so I'm sure there's always improvements to every piece of legislation, and I'm sure that the senator has done her best job in creating the best legislation. I don't know if this is the best, but I do know beyond a doubt that it's really our responsibility in this generation to stop the flow of these plastics in the environment, not only plastic bags, but plastics in general. But here today is an opportunity, and I encourage you to take this, because not only your children, but generations and generations will be sitting with the plastic that we're creating today. It won't be leaving the environment. And I appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Which Minnesota companies recycle plastic bags?
Are you talking about the people that pick it up, or are you talking about the stores that put the containers out? I'm sorry, Chair, I don't know.
Which companies actually do the recycling of plastic bags?
Oh, actually recycle the material. My understanding, and the PCA is here, and the people here, that Wayne's here, is a little bit more educated on this than I am, but I understand that there is at least one company, AGIS, that is a film recycler in the state of Minnesota, but... That's
Mr. Correct. Chair, yeah, I don't know if the PCA wants to testify, but we do have some information about products that can be made, and I believe there's a company in Minnesota that makes plastic, picnic tables and decking materials out of recycled plastic bags.
Hi. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Wayne Jurdy. I'm the Recycling Market Development Coordinator for the Pollution Control Agency. I'll talk a little bit about the end markets here. We have been working on film plastic. We do collect a fair amount of it in various venues. Most of that is collected in stretch film or the pellet wrap that you see, and there are some programs that collect the retail bags. There's two companies in the country. These names are Trex, which is plastic lumber. They use film in their manufacturing process. The other company is AERT, or Choice Decking. These two are number one and two in the country in terms of plastic lumber. Our own plastic lumber companies use actually the natural or milk jugs. And as Susan mentioned, we have a company that's coming online that's looking at silage bags, but we'll be looking at the we'll be able to process the retail plastic bags here in the next 6 to 12 months.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, I know that that there's a really well-established recycling plastic bag recycling program that's used by lots of businesses, retail businesses in the Twin Cities in particular, called It's in the Bag, and it's run, I believe,
it's RAM and WasteWise.
It's WasteWise is the name
and
of
RAM
them.
RAM is the association. There are two associations, WasteWise, which is a part of the Chamber of Commerce, and RAM, which is the Recycling Association of Minnesota, which are leading in that program. And they also have corporate sponsors as well as several grocery stores. I know Byerly's and Lund's, several of the co-ops, Mississippi Market, I know, is involved in that program. And it's a pilot program. And that was the program I was referring to. And they're getting some grant funds. The WasteWise folks, they're actually working with a group that works with people with disabilities, and so they're working with people with disabilities to do some of the collection and sorting, and the company that is doing some professional collection is a company called Merrick. So it's a pilot project in the state of Minnesota.
So I know we were hoping that Mark Blazer would be here. Is he here to talk about that?
Mr. Chairman, I know time is short, and we'll try and be as brief as possible. Mark Blazer, who is the director of WasteWise for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, was called away. He had another meeting at the Department of Commerce, and I apologize for that. I am Tony Quillis. I'm the director of environmental policy for the Chamber of Commerce. Minnesota WasteWise is an affiliate of ours, and as Ms. Hubbard and Senator Anderson have referred to, we have a program there called It's in the Bag. It's a voluntary program that we work with the grocers and the retailers. If you'll look, I think there's a handout in your packet. It goes through and kind of details the member companies that are involved in that, Pioneer Press, the Star Tribune, American Chemistry Council, the Pollution Control Agency, Super Value, Cub. The end market, is correct. There is a company named Merrick. It is a developmentally disabled company that employs 300 adults. That they kind of process these bags, and then as the Pollution Control Agency, as Wayne pointed out, Trex is the company that comes in and uses them. They take the recycled bags and use them for wood decking. I suppose, Senator, as a matter of fact, I think the Department of Natural Resources is one of the companies that processes these and uses the picnic benches, like Hired Hands out of Deer River up in Senator Saxog's district from Mel Gullickson, if Mel is still there. So there is a process in place right now that we have got, a voluntary program that WasteWise, it's a very successful program that we work with, and Jamie can probably elaborate a little bit more on that. The problem is that we've done it in the metropolitan area. It's a little bit tougher to do up at Koshin's IGA in Big Fork or in Brandon, Minnesota, in Senator Ingebrigtsen's district. It's a little bit tougher to do up that way. As Ms. Hubbard pointed out, the economics kind of drive it. It's kind of tougher to do in rural areas, and it's even a little tougher here. And if I could use the old adage,
Jen.
You can take a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. And so we can put up all these facilities that we need, but unless Senator Dibble and Senator Anderson and Jamie and I are taking the bags to the grocery store, it's kind of hard to do. But we have worked with Senator Anderson. We applaud her for bringing the bill forward. We think the goals are laudable. We all want to get to the cabin. We're just going to take, one of us is going to take 35 and one of us is going to take 94, and I think we're going to eventually all get to the cabin on this, and we've agreed to work with her on this as it moves through the process.
Thank you.
Just switch.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and many members of the committee. I'm Jamie Poole, the president of the Minnesota Grocers Association. The MGA is a trade association that represents the food retail industry since 1897. We have over 200 retail members with 1,200 stores statewide, as well as approximately 115 distributors and manufacturers. Our member companies employ over 8,500 union and non-union Minnesotans. When dealing with environmental legislation, I believe it's important to ask what is the desired result and how do we get there. Mandating what we are already doing effectively where straight infrastructure allows is not the best way to reduce waste. Many of the examples that you heard here have a more detailed infrastructure and are in positions to operate this through cities and other nations. The business of grocers and other retailers is determined by consumers' wants, needs, and demands. Therefore, grocers and retailers have responded by voluntarily offering plastic bag recycling. One of those programs, the innovative It's in the Bag program, was created in October of 2003 by local companies in partnership with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. This program collects plastics, grocery bags, retail bags, newspaper bags, dry cleaning bags, and many other types of plastic films you have every day in your homes. These are collected at local grocery stores and retail outlets. Collection is done by Merrick, a local nonprofit organization employing disabled Minnesotans. Last year, this program alone was responsible for collecting 1.1 million pounds of plastics. These were recycled into plastic decking. This program is voluntarily funded by over 130 stores. It's in the Bag is unique to the state of Minnesota, and it is just beginning to be replicated throughout the country. Why mandate what is voluntarily being done so successfully? This is not the only method of plastic, bag, and film recycling that is being practiced in the state. Several Minnesota-based suppliers pick up plastic bag and films from the stores they distribute to. Additionally, a program was started in Duluth as well as in Carver County. An independent rural grocer with a green heart offers plastic bag recycling and personally makes the five-hour trip round trip to the Twin Cities to deliver the film to Merrick for recycling. Our specific concerns on this piece of legislation are from the lack of rural support for programs like these. Many communities do not have plastic film recycling facilities to support the mandate, as we've heard. We believe the key to encouraging recycling is educating consumers and making it easy. It is our understanding that Merrick, the company that recycles plastic film for the It's in the Bag, is running at full capacity. Many communities do not offer curbside pickup of plastic film. Finding a way to correct these two issues would create green-collar jobs and further reduce the volume of plastic film in landfills, protecting our environment and reducing carbon emissions. The Minnesota Grocers Association and our partners in retail believe educating consumers is a critical step in reducing waste. In that vein, the MGA has applied for a grant from the PCA to start a public awareness campaign that encourages reuse in order to cut down on plastic film in the solid waste stream. The public service campaign will include opportunities for all retailers in Minnesota. Grocers have voluntarily borne the cost of programs for this program for years. Additional record keeping would be labor-intensive, burdensome, and costly to grocers. Grocers and our friends in the retail industry are looking for ways to educate consumers as it is the importance of recycling. At the end of the day, sustainability is a shared responsibility between business, government, and consumers. In closing, we do not believe a mandate is necessary, and we believe that all merchants who offer plastic bags can work together to find a feasible, easy solution. The entire retail community cares deeply about its consumers, its environment, and leaving Minnesota a little cleaner than we found it. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I'm welcome to answer questions.
How many bags in a pound? You said
45 bags in a pound.
So you're asserting that 45 million bags are currently being recycled.
1.1 million pounds were recycled.
And Mr. Chair, I asked Ms. Hubbard, she said that in Minnesota about close to 100,000 tons are being
disposed of,
okay, are being used. So we're talking about a lot more work that we have to do to really grapple with this. This has been great to hear about what the retailers are doing, and I've certainly seen this program in operation in some local stores, and I think it's great that they're doing this and they're having an impact. But I, excuse me,
But I think we have a broader problem, and we really need to figure out how to address the broader problem. And if there's 100 tons of plastic bags being used, new ones being put out there every year, I think we need to have a little bit more aggressive efforts to try to capture that waste stream and reduce the waste stream, which is what recycling will do. I think for a lot of consumers, they'd like to have an opportunity. If they see an opportunity to recycle more, they'll take advantage of it on the one hand. And on the other hand, if a really proactive vendor talks to the consumers or provides educational information, they can try to get, I think more consumers might open their eyes about the need if they haven't thought about it before.
How many, you ahead. Said there was a billion bags. What was your initial, Senator Anderson, your initial comments?
I don't know.
In Minnesota?
The number, go ahead. You have a better number, I think.
State data. We have composition analysis that the state did in 1999, which is by tons. And I understand now that there's 45 bags per pound, but I haven't done the calculation. So we only know that there's somewhere between 80 and 100,000 tons of this material in the garbage currently. We know, I don't know the actual consumption in Minnesota, and I'm not sure what it would take to figure that out. But if there's 100,000 tons in the garbage and there's 45 bags in a pound.
Oh, thanks.
So I just can't do that kind of math like that a lot.
Mr. Chair, the grocers have a really good, I think this just, this is that, this list is who is in the.
That's for just for it's in the
it's
bag.
It's in the bag
but,
program.
But certainly we have multiple other programs going on also.
That other grocers participate in. Mr. Chair, this bill would go beyond grocery stores and would affect retailers that use plastic bags for carrying out the items that you buy. So just think of the large drugstore chains that we go to, CVS, Walgreens, et cetera, and the superstore, the big stores that a lot of us probably make weekly trips to, Target, Walmart, those kinds of stores tend to use probably, I don't know, who's contributing the most plastic bags. It's not really, we don't really need to know that, except to know that that's a huge portion of the contribution of plastic bags. And I don't know if there's anyone here who can speak for those companies. Okay, the retailers can speak to that, about what they are now doing and what their position is. Hi.
Mr. Anderson, I'm in Target all the time. I've never seen this type of
collection
box or anything like that.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Buzz Anderson. I'm president of the Minnesota Retailers. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today, and I apologize to Senator Anderson for only having had someone talk to her within the last couple of hours. I've been trying to assemble information, and as you know, things are moving quickly around here. Target does not recycle bags, but that doesn't mean they aren't going to. They're in the process of examining how they can do it and what kind of processes to put in their store to better serve customers. Walmart does. Kohl's does, the Home Depot does, and that's part of what I want to talk about today is the fact that I have quite a number of members who are already recycled plastic film outside of the It's in the Bag program because they find it easier and more cost effective to do it within their own company structure.
The reason I was asking because Target is listed as a current sponsor of the In the Bag program.
Mr. Chair... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, they are a sponsor.
That means they contribute to it,
yes.
But that doesn't mean they participate in the collection part of it?
But so as they're in the process of planning how to do that, Mr. Chair, members. So they and a whole bunch of other companies are actually considering how they can best do this. I don't think there's any secret that that being green is good, and companies have caught on to that, and so they're initiating all kinds of green initiatives in their companies, whether it's better lighting, whether it's building their buildings with more sustainable materials and more energy-efficient materials. But a large number are already, as I said, recycling outside the It's in the Bag program. So they're already responding without a government mandate because, in fact, they want to take on that green label as part of their brand. And I think that's a good thing that companies are responding and that consumers are looking to companies that want that as their brand. I might also point out, members, that, and Mr. Chair, that one of the things we're concerned about is the cost in terms of when you use paper bags versus plastic bags, there's a bigger cost involved. They're more expensive. They're more expensive to ship. They're bulkier to deal with. And customers actually prefer plastic bags. What you'll find out, there's a lot of stores that offer their customers the choice of plastic versus paper. Consumers in our house all take that choice of using paper, although I have to get a few plastic bags from time to time to line my garbage cans at home, and also to I take the neighbor's dog for a walk, so I'll let you imagine what I use those for. We're also concerned about the reporting requirements. There's so many demands on business now to report all kinds of things, and to report the amount of plastic that we take back and recycle becomes one more additional burden on business that we'd rather not have. We'd rather just have an incentive rather to recycle. I would also point out that I have members who have stores in, all over the country, and they have stores in 50 states and multiple municipal boundaries. So you've got this sort of movement popping up all over the place, and some are asking that you put the City of New York logo on the bags or the City of San Francisco on the bags or whatever. And we're trying to say that whatever you do, you've got to make it simple, so that it's easier for us to do this when, in fact, we're trying to do more recycling. The marketplace is working. I'm fearful that we're actually moving too far too fast. I think that recycling will work in the marketplace if you follow three simple rules. One, make it easy for business to do. Two, make it easy for customers to abide by and to use. And three, we need more consumer education. And I think we're all becoming or am I environmentally aware, and I think that's a good thing. So I'll stop with that. Thank you for letting me speak, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.